Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the gloriously bronzed Richard Lee.
I am very fortunate in that department.
Mate, look at that tan. It's unbelievable. People can't appreciate it like I can right now.
This is a really weird moment.
Right, we're going to start this week's podcast with some feedback that we've had on last week's podcast, Andy Marshall. Now, we've had a lot of people mail in and tweet in regarding this, so I'm not going to pinpoint anybody. I'm just going to give it to you. Basically, he referenced in his chat that he didn't have a specific goalkeeper coach when he was younger. I don't think he's the first one to have mentioned that, and I know that you've referenced it a few times as well. So just give people a bit of background regarding this, because it does seem strange that there were no dedicated goalkeeper coaches, whereas now it's pretty much a must-have for every club, right?
Yeah, it is for every club now. It's quite a new occurrence, which is crazy, really. And I know I feel like I've said this same quote several times, but we are playing a different sport to the outfield players. You do need specific coaching. So the problem I had, not having that much coaching, goalkeeper coaching when I was younger, is you develop bad habits. And it's like everything. It's the whole cliche or the whole saying, practice makes perfect. Well, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. So, of course, if you're developing bad habits because you haven't had coaching in the younger years, it's that much more difficult to coach it out of you when you get that much older. Where I think I was quite fortunate was that, and I thought outside the box when I was younger, when I think about it now, was that I'd go home and I'd often coach myself and train myself. I watched a lot of top goalkeepers, so I would mirror a lot of what was going on, watching the likes of Peter Schmeichel and these kind of guys, mirror a lot of what they did and try to use those techniques myself. And then I'll go outside, and whether it was throwing a ball against a wall or there was a place in the house I could throw it quite high and practice taking crosses effectively. So I found ways that I could train myself, but I wasn't necessarily able to critique myself, of course, or give myself that quality coaching that I needed. Where I got lucky, had a couple of good coaches when maybe 12, 13, had a couple of coaches then. When I got to 15, 16, I had my first real goalkeeper coach. And thankfully, I think I was still young enough to improve enough to give me a career. But certainly now, I don't think you'll be able to have a career unless you get quality goalkeeper coaching at a younger age.
Excellent. Okay, well, if there's any other question you'd like Rich to answer, it's very easy to get it to him. Just tweet us at GK Union. On Instagram is at GK Union Official. Search GK Union on Facebook or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. This week's guest is one of football's fans' favourites. He's the all-time record appearance holder for Walsall. While playing for West Ham against Chelsea, he once saved a penalty from ex-Hammers midfielder Frank Lampard, and he's never one to shy away from a spot of light-hearted banter, as is evident in the book he wrote in his testimonial year. James Jimmy Wacker Walker, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you very much. How are you doing, Jen?
We're good.
Very well. Just that nickname, I've got to start there, Wacker. Now, I'm presuming it's just a funny way of saying Walker. Is that correct?
It basically is, yeah. And it's been pronounced a lot of different ways over the years as well, as you can imagine. A couple of letters have been changed, or one letter in particular. It was a school. I mean, my granddad was obviously Walker, and his name was changed to Whack, and I was a Whack throughout my school life. So anyone who knows me pre-Walsall days, like 1920, would call me Whack. And then when I got to Walsall, I turned into a Jimmy more, and Wacker changed to Wacker for some reason. No, why, I think. And then one of the journalists up there said, "Oh, is that because you kick it a long way?" So I just went with that, really, because it was hard to explain it. So yeah, that's the reason. Yeah, so it just stuck from that, really. So at Walsall, I'm a Wacker. West Ham and everywhere else, I've been a Jimmy from then on, really, as well. So three generations of Wacker and Jimmy.
You have a nickname, Rich?
I had one or two.
Yeah?
Yeah. We'll talk about them off air.
Okay, well, look, there's only one place to start. I've just referenced it, the book. Now, it's a great book, so many stories. For the purpose of those listening now, can you please reveal what the book was called?
So the book was called Size Isn't Everything. And I got a lot of stick as well, especially for the front cover. Basically, I'm a short arse for a goalie. Always was. Always got a lot of stick for it. At 5'10"-ish. I was 6'1" on my pink forms if I ever needed a move, but yeah. I'm about 5'10 and a half, realistically. But so the bloke taking the pictures of it, he went, right, the title of the book, sizing everything. Obviously, what are you talking about? You're sizing the goal or you're sizing the shower, sort of thing. So I had to do the, I give it the pose, he give me some sunglasses and props and that. And anyone's seen the front cover, I look terrible. And yeah, I've had stick for that over the years. But yeah, sizing everything is what it panned out to be. I can remember when I went to West Ham for the first time, just wanted to be reminded from that. And West Ham had played Walsall. I was at Walsall at Christmas time when the book was out. So they publicised it in the programme for me when they played West Ham. It was a big game, obviously. And so a few of the lads were still there when I turned up at West Ham in the summer. And like, especially Don Hutchinson and a few of the jokers in there. And they've like, I could hear the whispers going, I'm sure there was something about that book. Because I must have been looking at it in the programme going, what is this geezer doing? So when I've turned up, they're like, can you remember something about it? I could hear the whispers. I thought, right, I've got to quash this. So I went and got about 15 books, signed them all to Bobby Zamora, to Zamo, best wishes for the season, Jimmy Walker, to Don Hutch, all the best for the season, mate. I just put them in the lockers. Now, the first thing players do is, you know, Rich, when you get back in the change room, you go and check your phone.
Yeah.
So the lads are going in the locker. I put one in each locker as I got there and just sat there and waiting for the abuse to start, and one by one they've all come in, gone in the locker, gone, what the is this? What is this? That was it. But it got all the stick out of the way in the next couple of days and it was done then, so I was delighted.
Do you know what I've got to say? So any listeners listening in, you've got to Google this book, Google the cover of the book, because the cover is brilliant. The pose that you're pulling, it's the sunglasses, isn't it? The slightly dipped sunglasses that I like.
Yeah.
So what tends to happen, by the way, on this podcast is you'll get... Matt will ask the journalistic questions and he'll probe. I'm the goalkeeping geek. And the question I want to ask, because obviously you've referenced the book, the fact that size isn't everything. And you mentioned for a goalkeeper now, well, in fact, there's no Premier League goalkeepers at the moment, I believe, that are under 6 foot tall. The question I've got to ask for you is, do you think you would make it in today's game, given that you're not 6 foot?
Do you know what, Rich? It was one of those... It's a tough one, because like, I always remember Mick Kearns when I was at Walsall, and he was like sort of my guru over the 10 years I was there to start with. And he said, look, I always take a good big 'un over a good small 'un.
Yeah.
But whoever keeps the ball out the net the best is the goalie I'd have. I don't care about the height. Yeah. So it's one of them for me. And I always wanted to prove myself that I could do it, more to myself than anything, because I'd sort of said, you know, I'm good enough to do it in my own head. And then you had people like Andy Gorham and Barthez and people like that at the time, and Shilton weren't to be. So all people I looked up to, and I just wanted to prove to myself I could do it. Now, when I was playing, especially around the peak times, that was the time where then all goalies had to be 6'3", 6'4", and above.
Yeah.
You know, there was monsters. Everyone wanted a monster in goal, which is fair enough. Everyone's preference. And then I think sort of now it's turned a little. I know there's not any under 6 foot in the Prem, but they're not monsters now. You know, you've got De Gea's, and although they're a decent size, 6'1"s and that, they're not massive. So it's more, you know, it changed. The goalkeeper's evolved a lot, I think, and you're more involved with the team, and you're a starting point, a focal point for a lot of the attacks now. So listen, if you're a good 6'4" and you can do that, brilliant. But if you're sort of great on cross or whatever, you're not so good with your feet, it swings and roundabouts a little bit now in goalkeeping. So I think you've got to be more nimble around the goal, more quicker around the goal, especially with your feet, and move around that. So I think there is a place for it. And, you know, I'd like to think I could have done it still, yeah, to this day. But I like to say it's so quick now.
Yeah, it's interesting you say it. De Gea is interesting because you're right. 6'1", yet you see in a lot of places he's registered as 6'3", 6'4", but he isn't. He's 6'1", and I know we certainly had that in common. You know, I know when I was coming through, like, I'm very aware that I was one of them, that I'd measure myself, and I knew that in the morning I was 6 foot, but by the evening your spine compresses ever so slightly. I knew that I was 5'11" in the evening. So every, you look at every photo, every team photo, I'm on my tiptoes. Every opportunity to gain an inch or two.
I was the same.
Did it ever cost you like a move or anything? Because, you know, was there ever a time when maybe a team were interested but it was used against you?
Yeah, I think it was quite regular, to be fair. I sort of battled through it all my career, even from schoolboy football, really. Even like to understand, I never got taken on. I got taken on Notts County in the end by a guy called Alan Hill, who went to Forest after that. He was a goalkeeper there, and he was coach at Notts County. And we played them, and a lot of teams had looked. I think I was obviously around Mansfield area growing up. A lot of teams had looked. Mansfield had looked, Sheffield United, Forest, even Notts County before that. So they all looked, I was doing really well, but no one had actually, everyone more or less said I was too small to make it. I ended up playing the game at 15 against Notts County from a local team. It's called Sheepbridge. And we ended up getting beat 5-0, but I had a really good game, but I thought, well, it ain't going to take us after that, I'll just let five in. And Alan Hill came over and said, look, see something in you, would you come in for a trial? And that was it. I did really well in the trial. I ended up training with the first team that week because I was doing so well, and they took us on the schoolboy from that. But yeah, I needed that bit of luck definitely then just to get taken on, because everyone was basically, without looking at me for three or four games on the spin and seeing what I could bring, they just look for one game or a few minutes and go, too small, can't do it. And that set the scene more or less throughout the whole of my career. Like, even after playing so many games, I went into Walsall in Division 2. I went to Notts County, never quite made it at Notts. One reason or another, it was one of those things. Mick Walker actually was my youth team manager.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd done so well from his youth team manager, and we had a great youth team at the time. And I progressed with him to the reserve, youth team reserves, got a 2-year pro. He actually became manager, called me in his office, and I've got a piece of paper with what I want for a new contract. It's towards the end of the season. And he's called me, and I think, well, I'm going to sign a new one. He's called me and gone, yeah, you've not grown, you've stopped coming for crosses, we don't think you're going to be big enough to what you want. And this is someone I've grown up with over the last 3-4 years. I've done really well for him in every game. And even he said it. So I lost my head a little bit with him then, and I actually fell out of love with football a little bit then, but my dad got me back on the path and went, look, go and prove everyone wrong. In fact, he said, don't prove everyone, prove yourself right that you can do it. And that stuck me forever. And I ended up going on trial to Walsall, and there was a lad there, I can't remember the boy's name, he was from Coventry. Excellent goalie. I felt for him, actually. He was a 6'4", really good one, and he was quite polished. And for some reason, Mick Kearns, the goalkeeper coach there, and Kenny Hibbett, the manager at the time, took a shine to me. I don't know how, because the boy was at everything. I was overweight, I was little, I couldn't run. They were doing the running for the first 2 weeks, and I was terrible. And I just said to Kenny, said, look, I'm not a great runner, but stick me in goal, you'll see what I can do. And he went, do you know what? I liked you last year when I watched you, and I like what you've just said to me. I'm going to take you on a trip to Ireland, because otherwise he was just going to bid me off, because I was in bad shape, really. Went to Ireland, played some great games, and he signed me from there, and then it kicked on from there, really, Rich. But every year, it was like we got promoted. Right, is he good enough to do it in Division 1? He's going to get fat, his height's going to find him out in Division 1. Never did. Grafted away and did okay at that level. Same with the champ. And I just couldn't make that thing to the Prem. And there was a lot of talk of a lot of moves over the years. No one actually turned around and said, not taking you because of your height, but I can't think of any other reason why no one would have took me at the time. Do you know what I mean? Because I was playing as well as anyone in the champ at the time. It just, no one ever took the final push to take me, sort of thing. Got to sort of 29, I'm thinking, well, that's it, I might as well just make my career. I'm having a great time playing the champ, also loving it, it is what it is. And then after that, Alan Pardew took the chance on me, and he actually said, look, I've watched you for a few years when I was at Reading, I wanted to take you there, but your height always put me off, but you know, I've watched you for enough now, I know what you can do for me, and come in. But even then he was unsure what I was going to do at West Ham for him. And so it was one of them. And finally got to the Prem, longer story short, because I can go on a lot, but finally got to the Prem with him. And it was unfortunate, I did my knee, and I couldn't, after I'd done my knee, I got back to certain levels what I could do, but it was sort of, I was 31, 32 by the time I came back. I mean, I had a great season in the champ with West Ham. We got promoted. Came back, finally played in the Prem, felt great. But this is, you know, I could really belong here. I had a handful of games there and felt great. And then the knee sort of went again a bit, and it took 6 months. I couldn't quite reach them levels. So yeah, there's always a little bit of, I'd love to prove people wrong even more than I did. But it was fantastic. And for my height, it was, you know, I hope it inspired people a little bit who were similar to me. Myself, I've been told, got knockbacks for players. Even outfield players get told that as well. So can prove people wrong, and it's how much you want it, how much you're willing to work, and you get that bit of luck and you can overcome anything, really. But yeah, I had that all throughout my career, to be fair.
I mean, look, there's so much to get through here, and obviously you're not short of a story or two. But something stands out for me is that you made so many appearances for Walsall. You had that testimonial year, you wrote the book, and then you moved to West Ham. That was in your 30s. So despite the fact that, you know, you've been in the game for more than 10 years or so, is it fair to say that regardless of everything that came before that, that move to West Ham with Premier League football and going to the playoffs and the FA Cup final was actually when football really, really cranked up for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a fantastic time at Walsall. I loved every minute. The fans took to me from day one. I think they could see that I was giving everything I had. And it was brilliant. We rose through the divisions with them. I started in Div 2, so I would have been Division 3 then. And we went through, and as it changed over, we had like an unprecedented 4 years in the champ. But like I said before, it was one of those that I actually didn't think the big move would ever come. And I was quite happy with my lot at Walsall, to be honest. I was loving it, but you know, I obviously wanted to prove it to myself. But then when West Ham took the chance on me, that's when, you know, I saw a sort of different side of football. And I mean, West Ham was a fantastic, fantastic club, and I loved every minute. Like you say, at 30, you start thinking it's never going to happen now. But then to go from there, I had an unbelievable 6 or 7 years there. I mean, I had 5 years at West Ham, and like I said, there was always something every year. First year we got promoted from the champ to the Prem. I did my knee, unfortunately, with about a minute to go in the final. And then after that, it was a toughest year of my life. Because I've waited to get to the Prem all my life. Finally got there with a team I've sort of fell in love with, a club I fell in love with, and want to do really well for, and want to play in the Prem with them. And I've bust every bit of my knee I can bust. It was a hard road getting back, and it took me about 9 months all in all. And again, Pa just took a gamble on me then, because he was going to get someone else in the January to help Shaka and Stevie Bywater was there. So he was going to get someone in Jan to help them out and just have a bit of backup with them. And the physios had wrote me off for the year, and sort of everyone had wrote me off to be finished, to be honest. But I dug right in, and I give Pa a date in February that I'd be fit and back fit and playing for him. And he's like, well, the physios are wrote me off, Jim. The doctors say you can't do it. I went, look, trust me. Please, don't get anyone in. Give me a chance. I'll be back with you. And I played my first resi game on the day I said. And within 2 weeks of playing that game, I made my debut in the Prep.
Okay, so leading up to that, your third game at West Ham was what we mentioned at the top of the show, the Chelsea game in the League Cup. The Frank Lampard penalty. Now, I showed this to Rich before we came on air. And listen, great save. Huge occasion in front of the West Ham fans. And I'm not saying this is a fair rule for goalkeepers, and perhaps it should be looked at, but you were miles off your line.
Oh, miles off. Miles off. Miles off. Yeah. To be fair, it was one of those. I mean, like you say, I think I'd played a couple in the League Cup before at home, and it was, obviously we drew Chelsea, which was great, and I'm thinking, well, I've got to get in the game here, which I did. And it was my away debut, really, and that's the first taste of there's 8,000-9,000 West Ham fans behind the goal, and it was, the atmosphere was incredible. I was thinking, this, I belong here, this is what I want to be doing. And it was one of them. I had a really good game. I couldn't see me getting beat, to be honest, and I tipped one on the post, it just sneaked in. But after that, I didn't realise the animosity to Lampard at the time. And as the I think Repka, the crazy man, has just cleaned someone out in the box, and ref pointed to the spot, rightly so, Andy Durso pointed to the spot. And for eight, it must have been, it felt like 20 minutes, it must have been at least 7 or 8 minutes. It was going off, Repka's fighting everyone, coins are coming on the pitch, the Mars bars are coming down, the pies are coming on. And I knew I arrived a little bit, because it was like, at Walsall, if you have, or Division 2, you got coined, it was like 10 p's had come down and that. There was 2 quid knocking around on the goal, I'm stuck and everything. But I'm thinking, even Lampard, he can't be like cool under this pressure. So he's just going to smash it. So like you said, I went straight down the line of it and got a block on it. I'd like to say it was a perfect save to the bottom corner and that, but it literally hit a knee and went miles. But the funny story was, I mean, Martin Tyler did the ITV that night. He sent me a DVD through. Well, it was a video back in them days, actually. He sent me a DVD with a note going, great performance, Jim. Thought you might want to see your saves back. Got a great camera angle from the ITV camera. Just, and he gets a footnote, he went, just as you saved a penalty, just have a look at Andy Durso on the linesman. Hello, what's he talking about? I watched the video. I forgot about what he said at the bottom. I was just watching the saves and the penalty saves. I thought, oh, let me go back to that. So as I save it, bear in mind it's gone off for a good 7 or 8 minutes, and the West Ham fans are going mental behind the goal. Everyone's going mental. As I go down the line of it, it's hit me knee and gone down there, and everyone's run off after the ball. The linesman's waving furiously with his flag, and this is the days before they had the communication, the mics on the communication. You can see the linesman furiously waving, and Andy Durso running away doing the hand across his throat as if to say, F that, play on, just wrap the ball, going, play on. That was it. So my moment of glory was nearly taken from me.
That's amazing.
I saw Andy Durso at a game, funny enough, a couple of months ago. And I said, can you remember it? And he went, oh, he says, I couldn't do anything else, Jim. He said, if I'd have retook the penalty and he'd have scored, the game would have got abandoned. The West Ham fans would have been on pitch. He said, I had to. He said, he got in so much trouble for it as well at the time.
Really?
But I think it was the right decision. It would have been carnage. I said I would have helped you out because I would have saved the next one as well.
That is brilliant. Then came the playoffs, right? Came the playoffs later that season. Preston at the Millennium Stadium now. A huge game because West Ham had missed out the previous campaign. You won, but you mentioned there earlier that you suffered an injury. Just talk us through that specific incident.
Well, it was to set the scene, like I said, playing the Prem is what I'd always dreamt about, and I was that close. And like I said, I fell in love with West Ham in the season there. It was a fantastic club. Fans are incredible. I love the lads. And it was one of them. We had a young side at the back, Anton Ferdinand and Elliot Ward, who was really good players, but they're only 18. So I felt it on me to take the onus, and I thought, you know what, if anything comes in this box during this game, I'm going to come and take it. I'm getting the Prem. There's nothing stopping. And with like a minute to go, we was under under severe pressure sort of thing, and they got a free kick in our half, and it was coming in the box. I've just said, look, keep a high line. I'm coming. Let them put it in there. And it's coming. I've started early, and it's the highest. I've only watched it back twice. It was too painful to watch. But it was one of those. It came in the box. I've come early. I'm committed. I could have probably stayed and let Anton or Elliot have a challenge, you know, about 15, 16 yards out and let them deal with it. But I thought, I'm not doing it. I'm dealing with it. And as I came, the highest I've ever been, by the way. That's probably why it went. Everybody weren't used to landing from that high. But as I've took it, you can just see me come and take it on bodies. And I'm quite close to the edge of the box and I'm landing. But it's a movement you do quite every day, really, in training. You know, you land and as you're landing, sort of change direction and move off another way. But on this particular occasion, as I've landed right sort of close to the 18-yard line, I've planted my foot so I didn't go any further forwards to stop my momentum. And the plan was just to collapse on the ball in the box and stay down for about 2 minutes and see the game out. As I've took it, I've caught it, and as I've landed my knee, I don't know what happened to this day. I've never felt pain like it ever. It was agony. I didn't know what I was doing. I've managed to get hold of the ball as I've gone down. It was like a surreal moment. God, what has just happened? I look around, I'm outside the box because obviously I've not been able to stop my momentum. I've grabbed the ball back in as it's close to me, and the refs obviously blew up for I was outside the box. I was a good yard out by the end, and they're going mental. I should be sent off for that. And I'm thinking, I don't know what's even happened. Like, what? And then the physio, John Green, came on and like, he's just relax. And he's felt me knee. He's gone, yeah, listen, don't worry. Just sit there, you're done. It was a weird one. Because if anyone's ever done the ACL, it's painful at the time. I mean, I'd come from such a force, from such a high, the pain was incredible. But after that first few seconds, and by the time John came on, I'm thinking, I'm all right here. I'm okay. I'm fine. John's like, no, trust me, you're not. Yeah. I said, no, John, how long's left? He went, there's a few seconds left. I said, just strap it. Strap it up. Get me out there. I'll save the free kick. We're done. He's like, no, trust me. Lie back down. You're going off. And like, to be fair, it took us off. And it was like, from then on, it was a bit of a blur. I think, can't remember who the ref was. I think he might have been Mike Riley. I'm not sure. He gave us a yeller to rub a bit of salt in my wounds as well.
Cheers.
As I'm getting stretched off. And I've gone, and bear in mind, I've been celebrating sort of in front of the Preston fans it was too far to run from the Millennium from the goal to celebrate with Bobby at the other end who scored. I thought I'd never make it back in time. So I was just, as you do, I've turned around a bit to the Preston fans and give them a little bit and had a celebrate with them, yeah. Which they weren't too happy about. And then, ironically, 10 minutes later, I'm getting stretchered off in front of them. Oh. So I got a bit of abuse from them.
Yeah.
Gone past manager at the time, Dave Kelly was the coach as well, and I forget his name at the minute, Billy Davis. So they've consoled me as I've gone past, and I've ended up watching the, and there was 7 minutes of injury time or something ridiculous after that. And I remember they put me, I've gone from the height of being out there, got back to go to the Prem, to in this first aid room it was.
Yeah.
Not even the change room, they put me in the first aid room. It was the tiniest room, and the smallest TV in the top bit, like a one of them old things you get in a caravan or something. And in the top corner, and I'm watching the game, what I should have been playing on, in this screen with it. I mean, my dad's found his way down, and it's one of those, that's a surreal moment. Like, I've been playing out on the pitch a minute ago in front of 90,000 fans, and now I'm in a room on my own with my knee throbbing. And sort of like, John Green came in to celebrate with me, then Big Ludo came in, and I've gone, right, get me out on the pitch, I'm going out. He went, no, whatever you do, you've got to just keep your feet up. I went, no, John, forget that, get me out there, now. And then I ended up getting some iconic pictures on Ludo's shoulders.
Yeah,
with a champers. I mean, John had put the biggest bandage around my leg you've ever seen, and I don't know how Ludo got me on his back. To be honest, I'm not the lightest anyway, and with this big bandage on. But we did the lap of honour and that, and it was great. And I sort of put it to the back of my mind, but you know, I could see the doctors chatting about things after, and they're shaking their heads, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not great. This physio at the time, he still uses it in all his lectures. He does. He used the footage from it because he's obviously the force I landed with and that. I mean, I snapped my ACL, I snapped my lateral ligament and did the meniscus in the on the lateral side. I did a little, the only thing intact was the posterior. It took 9 months all in all. But yeah, it was a real tough time. Real tough time. I don't think it's been any tougher actually. You know, when you've worked all that, you've worked all them years to get to where you want to be. You've actually found a place where you can do it at, and you really want to be a part of it. And it's taken away from you. It's cruelly taken away, sort of, with a minute to go. I was living in Essex, and it was a great place. Everyone loved West Ham, and I probably didn't do myself any favours for 3 or 4 of those months. I was going out a lot, and that escalated as well. And you end up getting in quite a dark place. And it was only John Green. I mean, I talk about it in the book I'm writing now, like with the rest of it. I talk about it in that where, like, I went back to see John Green. John Green had left the club by the time, but I went back to see him after a while. He said, "Oh, come in, let's have a look." And he went, "Look, the state you're in, you're finished. Unless you sort of can turn this around right now, there's no comeback for you." And that just gave me the news that, well, not the news I needed, but the kick up the backside I needed. And I wanted, you know, I wanted to go back in and play in the Prem. I wanted to give it another chance. I didn't want to just peter out then. So it was one of those. I really got me arse in gear then, and kicked on. It was like 5:30 in the gym every morning, full days, got bed at 9 o'clock, and I was in the best shape I've ever been by the time I came back.
Well, I mean, it was nearly a year to the day, right, that you were back at the Millennium Stadium, FA Cup final against Liverpool, the famous FA Cup final, the 3-3. You were on the bench that day. How close were you to actually being in the starting lineup? Because it was Shaka Hislop, right, that started the game.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to be fair to Shaka, I mean, I was as close as Pars has not made his mind up on the Friday before it.
Wow.
And obviously, I was in his head massively because everyone had wrote me off. Like you said, it was more or less a year to the day. So I'm in Pars's ear going, "Gaffer, it's fate. You have to play me." Everyone's wrote me off. We come back to this, to the same place, a year to the day. You can't get any more clearer signs, Gaffer. You've got to play me. And me and Shaka was alternating. It was a weird one because I'd sort of, normally your number two would play the cup games, and the number one at the time, it was Shaka, would play the league games. But it turned around a little bit because we're doing so well in the FA Cup. Shaka was playing the FA Cup game, and I was playing the league games, which I didn't mind. I was quite happy playing in the Prem anyway, but we actually played Liverpool at home at Upton Park about 3 weeks before the end of the season. So obviously we knew we was playing in the final. And I played in the game, and I ended up, Cisse cut inside on the edge of the box and hit one. And it, you know one of them, Rich, you know one of them near posts where everyone calls it near post, but it's not a near post.
Mm.
It's just a goal, it's just a good strike. Yeah. But it happened to be on my near post. And I've got a finger ended onto it and it's hit the post and gone in. And we got back in the game, 1-1, and then the other end, Cisse, it again, come down, and one-on-one, he slotted it past me. And we end up losing the game 2-1. And Pards pulled me on the Thursday, and I've been in his ear, and I've been playing really well, training well, I'm looking good. I'm like, come on, Gaffer, you've got to play me. Called me in on the Thursday before it. So it weren't the Friday, it was the Thursday before it. And he's gone, he said, look, really tough decision, but I've got to go with Xhaka. Like, he's played every round. I can't not play him. It kills Xhaka. I think it's the right thing to do. I'm like, I said, Gaffer, there's no room for sentiment here. You can't. You've got to play it. You've got to do it. And in the end, he said, no, look, my mind's made up. I'm going with Xhaka. I went, listen, I understand. I do. I'm 100% behind the team and Xhaka. And I leave from that, as disappointed as I was. That was a tough decision to take.
Mm.
Tough decision. Because playing in that would have been, you know, one of the best comebacks of all time.
Yeah, well, I've got to ask the question. You know, the last-minute strike from Gerrard, would you have saved it?
I know what you're going to say. I know. Do you know what, right? And it's one of those, Rich. You can always say, I look back on goals now, and I look at goals going now, and I go, nah, I'd have saved that. But I genuinely, at that time, feel that was my game lower down as well. I was quick, low, obviously, being a low centre of gravity. If he shoots from 35 yards like that, I 100% think I save it, which hurts even more. It hurts me every day. Whenever it gets mentioned, it hurts me even more, because then, obviously, it went down as Gerrard's final. I think, listen, you never know what would have gone on before that, but that instance alone, I think that being my game would have been something I might have saved.
Mm.
Do you think
that makes it even harder to save.
Yeah.
Do you think if you'd not played Liverpool a few weeks prior, do you think that made a big difference that it was Liverpool that you played?
I was massive. I mean, Pards said that, you know, if you'd have saved me at least one of those against Liverpool and we'd have got a draw, I'd have thrown you in.
Wow.
Mm. I know. And I had a really good game against them as well. I remember Robbie Fowler played and he had a couple left and I made some great saves. And just the one really for me that it's a near stick. It is near post, but it's not. It's cut inside. It opens up the whole goal and he smashed it back across and it's one of those. That's why I get even more infuriated when, like, the pundits will go, oh, it shouldn't be beat his near post.
Yeah.
That, and they just say it flippantly. Well, it's not his near post. It's just a good strike. If he's in the middle of the goal and struck it there to one post or another, it's going in anyway.
Yeah. Well, do you know what you tend to find is you see the amount of goalkeepers that end up over-covering their near post so they don't make that mistake but get beaten really easily on the far post.
Really easily.
But no one
selfish,
says
selfish goalkeeping, isn't it?
That's it. It's not effective, you know. But there's a game you can play. I think I learnt this a bit when I was playing, where there's a game you can play to avoid criticism. You know, like, you know, the things that will get you criticism, and that's certainly on the list.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a couple of individuals. One in particular, because I shared a room with this guy, England under 21s, by the name of Stephen Bywater. You mentioned him.
Yeah.
He came on for you in the playoff final. He was a character.
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, I roomed with him as well for, must have been 2 years.
He's a nutcase.
And he's a nutcase. Absolute, absolute crazy man. Absolute crazy. I mean, it was a crazy squad there at the time when I came into it, West Ham. You had Stevie Lomas, you had Bywater, you had Donny Hutch. There was a lot of craziness there at the time. Mm. I remember going in on one of the first days and Lomas was trying to get fit. And he was riding a push bike everywhere. He lived in Loughton, which is like 5 miles from the training ground. And he'd bike that every morning and bike it back. So as we're going, Steve was obviously last out because he was injured. Bywater's has punctured both his tyres in his bike. So he can't get home. So he's had to schedule a lift off whoever's left at the ground and all that. And he found out it was Bywater. The next day, there was 4 pitchforks in Stevie Bywater's tyres.
No.
And I thought, at that moment, I'm not getting involved in this. I'm staying well clear of it. But yeah, it was Mike Waters was an incredible character. I mean, probably nothing I can even mention on the podcast if I'm being honest right now about him. But do you know what? He's a really good goalie. But I mean, I don't know, did you hear the story when he first on one of his debut for West Ham? They've got the big screen in the corner at Upton Park, didn't they? And he used to put the game on as it was going on.
Yeah.
And he came off the bench for, I can't remember, it might be Craig Forrest. He told a story. And he came off the bench, Harry Redknapp's put him on. And he's come off the bench, because Craig's got injured, he's running in the goal, and he's like, oh, this is, you know what Steve's like? He's a just big kid, isn't he?
Yeah.
But a very big kid. And he's like, oh, this is great, debut. Yeah, great. He's looking around, and he's watching the game on the big screen. He says, looking at that, and I go, oh, that looks like me there. The ball's just rolled past the post, just missed, and he's looking at the screen going, and everyone's going, what are you doing? And he said he didn't even see it. It was just what he was, that engrossed in the big screen. He didn't even see someone having a shot until it had gone past him. He's like, oh, shit. So Harry's asked him at half time, oh, Steve, what are you doing? Now, normally you'd try and style it a little bit, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Oh, sorry, Gaffer, I was unsighted or something.
Yeah.
Defender was in my way. I weren't quite switched. He went, oh, sorry, Gaffer, I was watching the big screen. Didn't see it. I mean, imagine Harry, can't you? He's gone mental. You didn't see it. Are you kidding me? That was his first and last game for West Ham, I think.
I think that was actually the Bradford, the crazy game against Bradford. I think they won 5-4 or something like that.
I think it might have been, yeah.
Well, your time at West Ham eventually came to an end, and this is an interesting one because you moved to Spurs for a season. You didn't actually play there, but it was the first year they made the Champions League. A minefield of goalkeepers, it seemed, at the time. I mean, you came in, they had Carlo Cudicini, Aurelio Gomez, David Button was coming up from the youth, and they also had Ben Anik as well.
Yeah.
You were part of that troop. What was that like?
It was incredible. It was an incredible year. It was one of those, like you said, West Ham sort of, the first 3 years were amazing. The fourth year, I was on the bench a lot, and I was still involved. The final season petered out a little bit, and I ended up going on loan to Colchester, just to play some football, really. Played under Paul Lambert there. So I obviously know him from the Ipswich connection now. And that was on there, just to play some football. And I felt good, to be honest. I felt really good. And Derby had actually come in for me during that time. Nigel Clufford rang me. And I'd shook hands on a deal with Nigel. They just had to stay up. Their end of the bargain was to stay up. And it was going to get me in the championship. They had... Funny enough, they had Roy Carroll there, Steve Bywater, Lewis Price, and so I thought, well, where do I sit in all that? And he said, no, he wants it to, Roy's going, Lewis Price is going, it'll be you and Stevie fighting out for it. I said, well, that's fine by me, I've done that before, I'm more than happy to do that again, like, and, you know, hopefully I'll play some football there. And so I shook hands on it. They played Bristol City at home, went to watch the game, saw it before, agreed all the figures and everything. I used to do it without an agent as well, so I went on my own, took my dad's, we shook on it, we went, all the best for the game. They won the game, which more or less kept them up. So I just said, look forward to seeing you in July. And then, long story short, got to July and no contact from Nigel. I'm trying to get hold of him. I'm going, something's not right here. And he, as we shook hands, he went, look, it doesn't matter. If enough, I can't get them out, I still want you in, because they're not going to be with us. So, okay, brilliant. Shake hands. I batted off a few deals. Colchester offered me a great deal. A couple of us were in the offing, but I batted it off because I was happy with Derby. I couldn't get hold of him. Got to middle of July. I'm like, Nigel, what's going on? And I said, look, I just dropped him a text in the end. I said, I'm going to come down the training ground because I need to know what's happening. Basically, he finally got back to me. He said, look, Jim, the chairman's pulled the plug on it, really. I've got to get them two out. I'm like, what did we say? We shook hands on it. That was the question I asked. Like, I could have gone and got myself sorted now. So basically I'm getting into sort of August with no club. And he sort of said, look, come into train and you know, be around it, and hopefully we can get them two out before it goes, and we'll get you in. The chairman will do it then. So I had nothing else, so I agreed to it. I sat there for a week and all that, and it just didn't sit right what was happening, really. And I can remember being in the Derby canteen, and there's not long left of the window. And I sat with Jake Livermore, funny enough, because he was on loan from Spurs at the time. I was just chatting with Jake, and Harry came up on the screen in the canteen on Sky Sports, you know, doing his usual pose out the Range Rover window with Bondi driving, and he's in the passenger. And the window's gone down, and they've asked him the question, any more signings, Harry? And Harry's batted it off like he usually does and goes, No, we just probably need a bit of experience cover. I think he said right back, and probably need a bit of experience cover in the goalkeeping department. Mm. And I'd spoke to Harry in the summer, and he was one I'd sort of battered off because I thought, well, with the goalies they've got there, I'd be fourth, fifth choice. So I batted it off. But when he said that, I went, oh, hello. So I rang Harry, and he's gone, yeah, Jim, yeah, all over it. We're desperate for a bit of experience in that department. Like, come down and train. I said, well, look, I'm at Derby, but nothing's happening. I mean, he went, if you can get down, come down, train the next 3-4 days, and if you can show me you can still do it, like, there's a deal for you.
Wow.
I went. I got in the car, said to Jake, maybe goodbye, didn't even say anything to Nige, went straight down, end up going down there, and obviously that was it. I trained really well for the week. I was fit enough, and that was it. Signed on a 1-year deal, and it was an incredible year. I didn't tell anyone I was going there either. So when it popped up at the ticker tape at the bottom of Sky on the yellow thing, I must have got about 500 texts ranging from who's your agent? And I wanted, your agent must be Carlsberg, or.
Yeah.
A couple was nice ones going, well deserved, mate. You deserve that move. Go on, crack on. Teddy Sheringham sent me a lovely message, to be fair, and I still remember that. And he said, look, you're up there with the goalies I've played with. Believe in yourself because, you know, you've got a chance to go and play there. It's a great club, another great club you're going to, and go and do well, and you've got a chance to play. And I was like, oh, I appreciate that. It's come from him. Mm. You know, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So Rainer went there, signed a year, and it was an incredible year. And I mean, the goalies they are showing. I mean, Gomez. The way it was panned, Gomez was injured. So Cudicini was playing and Gomez was injured, and they thought he was going to be out for about 12 weeks. So obviously they had Ben Anik as well, he was a very good young goalie then. Still a very good goalie, but not so young. Mm. And like you say, you had Button and a couple of other young ones. So they needed that bit of experience. So it worked a treat for me. But I was due to play in the League Cup. Because Kudus was playing the league games, but Gomez went back to Holland, did whatever he did, and got back fit within about 6 weeks. And he came back and he played in that game, and I was on the bench. So I missed out playing in there just. And then from that moment on, Gomez was sensational. I put him down as, I mean, he had some high profile ricks the season before, but from that season when I was there, just speaking about that time, he's the best goalkeeper I've ever worked with or seen. He was incredible.
Wow. Really? Wow.
He was incredible in training. This is when I started thinking about coaching more than anything, because you had Cudicini, Italian style. Everything was polished. It was like a Rolls Royce he was. Going over hurdles, looked amazing. Jumping about, amazing. Didn't make loads of saves in training, but come to a game, he made loads of saves. He was fantastic. Mm. And Gomez was... He had this Brazilian thing. I've never seen it before. And he'd go on one knee and by one post, and he'd get me to throw a ball from the 6-yard box on level with the other side of the post, drop it, and as I dropped it to pick it back up to throw it in the top corner, he had one push off. This is, bear in mind, he's on his knees by the other post. One push off a knee, one push off a leg, and he'd claw it out the top bin in the other corner.
Wow.
And I'm like, look at it again. I tried it. I was doing it. I could only do it in half a goal. It was incredible. I don't even know how you're doing that, Gomes. But he was sensational. That's when I really got to thinking about goalkeeping more than I ever have.
You've actually moved more as a goalkeeper coach than you have as a player. You know, you've
gone, absolutely.
Obviously, Lincoln, Sunderland, and now Ipswich. Obviously got a passion for your coaching, and I know you've got another project that you're involved in as well. Football DNA, I believe it's called. A bit of information on that. And your philosophy when it comes to coaching.
Well, the coaching, I mean, I went back to Walsall to play after Spurs. It was one of those, I could have stayed, and Harry wanted me to stay and be around the lads and go into coaching then. But, you know, and it would have been, looking back, it would have been a fantastic decision, because I'd have been probably in and around it by now and embedded in the framework of Spurs. But I felt great. I'm training every day with like Defoe's and Modric and Bales, and you know, the best players in the world, and I'm doing really well. I'm enjoying playing. I'm thinking I need to go and play. And Walsall was really struggling at the time, and they've sort of said, look, come back and help us out, basically. Mm. So I did, and end up this. I put coaching on hold for a little while. Still did bits when I was there, but I put it on hold for a little while. I did my badges while I was doing it as well, so I was still thinking about it, but ended up having a great couple of years at Walsall. And then after that, I left this sort of mid-season, February time, for one reason or another. It weren't quite working out that last season. So instead of falling out of everyone, I thought I'm going to leave on a sort of a high, or while I still like everyone and everyone likes me. So I left there and I ended up going to Peterborough. And Peterborough was my first coaching job with Darren Ferguson. And he took me in. I mean, I basically sort of fibbed a little bit about me coaching. That I've been doing it for the last 2 years at Walsall. I never had. He said, oh, brilliant. Well, we need a number two, number three, and we need a coach who can do it both. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. So I learned on my feet fast.
Yeah.
And it was great. And that taught me so much already. And I had a couple of great scenes at Peterborough. And you sort of learn and you think back to things you've done. I mean, I was fortunate enough to play with some of the best goalies in the world. I mean, Gomez was sensational. So I've learned his Brazilian side, Cudicini's Italian side, all the work I've done throughout my career, more or less from the English side of things, if you will. And so I'd learned a lot from then. It was only like, as I started thinking about it at that time, sort of started piecing it all together. So Peterborough was more or less my guinea pig, really. It was great to try things out, and it worked really well, to be honest. And we had a great time, and I loved it there. And that's what sort of embedded me in. And I ended up going to Palace with Alan Pardew for a little while, which was great. Loved that. That gave me the taste of what I wanted to do. And I ended up going to Gillingham with Justin Edinburgh after that. And I sort of, after Gillingham, I thought I weren't sure if it was for me or not. I'd learned so much of it, and I had so much to give back. And I had my style of coaching, and what I thought worked with the goalies I was working with. But I just didn't really, especially at Gillingham, I loved Justin down there and loved the lads. The chairman of the club weren't really what I was used to. And I thought, I let end up leaving there towards before the season ended, because it was a long way from home. I weren't enjoying it as much, and I left there and I thought, it's time to go. And I've always been a believer of when it's time to go, it is time to go. There's no point just doing it. So we had the conversation. I went, and I even thought about sacking it off there in clubs. And I set up my own academies, set up like young goalkeeping academies, working with like 6-year-olds up to, adults again. And it was going really well. I was doing like 4 or 5 nights a week at different places locally, and one in Essex, one in Stamford where I was living, and ran 4 nights a week. I'm really enjoying it, and I never took the kids before, so I learned a lot from that as well. And I transferred, because you can't do exactly what you do with the first team with the kids, but a lot of the principles are still the same, just got to break it down a lot more. So I really enjoyed that. So I was torn whether or not to go back into it, and Lincoln actually came up through a friend of a friend's, and Danny and Nick Cowley are the Essex boy from Essex, and I knew a lot of the lads who knew their mate, sort of thing. And they said, look, they're going in here, it's a big job for them, will you go and help them? So I spoke to Dan, liked him, and said, yeah, look, I can't help you. So I did that part-time. Obviously, during that time, they sort of wanted me to go full-time, and I sort of batted it off a little bit. But when they got back in the league, I thought, right, now it's time to do it with them. And I did it, and it was great. I had a great year. Couldn't quite do all my academies that I was doing, so I let a couple of them go. And it was from there I thought, do you know what, I really enjoyed doing the full spectrum. I really enjoy... And, like, doing academies opened my eyes to, like, so you've got the mums and dads giving the feedback of, oh, it's great, he's getting good coaching, he's never had good coaching. And they turn up on a wet, cold Tuesday nights, Thursday nights, and want the best for their kids and not quite getting the coaching they've had. And all. So I thought, while I was at Lincoln, I had a bit more time, and, I sort of started producing the drills that I do. And I thought, I wonder if goalkeepers... Like, it works for outfield players the same. A lot of outfield players not getting the right coaching. I mean, I'd never call any coach that takes a kids team, because they're giving up their time for nothing. They're doing the best they can. I just thought, maybe there's a way that I could help them and give... Because, Rich, like, the football world's a very closed world at times, unless you're in it and know people in it. It's hard to get into and hard to get... And I'm thinking, well, you've got all this great stuff from inside footballs that I've learned over the years, from the Prem down to the conference as it was the year before. And I wonder if there's a way I can open it up to everyone, so even coaches can go on it, and it'll help coach the kids better, and the kids will get better, and everyone wins basically. It was something that we looked at doing, and with Stuart England, who's the analyst at Lincoln with me at the time, we just ended up putting a few drills together and had a mess about for a bit, and thought, this could work really well. So we ended up just going down that route, and Football DNA was born from that, and it was sort of a hobby in the sideline sort of thing, and we thought we'll just put it on there, see where it takes us. And it's been the response to it's been incredible. We've put what we think's the best
of everything on every content from different coaches who are working in the game and things I've learned and the sports science side, the wellness side of it and all that. And we've got some great interviews on there. I interviewed John Motson with it. Mm. And it's took us to some great places. And I've spoke to lads that I probably wouldn't have spoke to. You know, you lose touch a little bit, don't you? And I'm back in touch with Dean Ashton and did an interview with him. And his story was incredible about getting injured on England duty and all that. And proper emotional. And he's put a couple of sessions on Marlon Harewood and people like that. So it just escalated loads. And so we've sort of turned around now. It's doing really well. And said, look, what can we do to give back? You know, we can't not charge people and we have done already. So we're working at the minute at starting the Football DNA Foundation, which we want to go, and we're not going to limit it to one charity or two charities. We're going to try and any sort of worthwhile causes, whether it be grassroots football. We even talked about, you know, a benevolent fund for ex-pros who can't, the PFA can't help them for whatever reason, or the FA can't help them, mental health issues or anything. If we can help out anything like that, or, you know, your other charities. I mean, there's a little girl at West Ham who I've been involved with a lot called Isla Caton, who's done amazing. She's been in the news like lately. She had a treatment, this new cancer treatment, and Touchwood's done incredible, and she seems to be clear from it, and it's amazing. So we want to, if we can use any of that on top of that to help anything like that, that's what we plan to do now.
Great stuff. And the last question that we always ask everyone on the podcast, and we've had some really interesting answers to this, so interested to get your answer. Jimmy, what has goalkeeping given you?
Oh, jeez, what a good question. Do you know, goalkeeping has been my life, basically. There's nothing like it. I mean, you could testify to that. There is nothing like being a goalkeeper. You know, you're in a team, but you're on your own. You're with fans, but you're on your own.
Yeah.
But you've got such a camaraderie with everyone, and I think everyone sort of looks up to the goalkeeper. So it's just given me, you know, an amazing life. I've loved every minute of being a goalkeeper. It makes you feel strong at times. It makes you feel so vulnerable at other times. It can take you to the biggest highs, the lowest of lows. I wouldn't change, you know, one second at all. It's been an amazing goalkeeping life so far, and you know, hopefully it can continue.
Top stuff, Jimmy. Some great anecdotes there, mate. Some great insight. Definitely, I think we'll have to do a part two, perhaps with the new book.
Oh, with the new book, definitely. Because, like I said, it's hard to do because there's that many stories to go, and a lot of it can't be said. I've got to be careful where it's said, but in the book, I can sort of like put anything I like now as well. So they're all in there, and I've got all the West Ham stories and Spurs stories in there. So I've had to consult the lawyers on a few stories when I've spoken to a few of the other lads.
You got a name for that one, by the way?
I'm really torn with that one because size and everything is a great title. So I don't know if to go, actually, size was everything. Right, the second book. I don't know. So I'm torn with it at the minute.
Brilliant. Jimmy, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Enjoyed every minute. Thank you.
Well, that was Jimmy Walker, mate. Top bloke. What a bloke. Some great stories there.
Yeah, fantastic. For me, and I went into a bit of depth on it because I was really keen to ask him about this. He made the point, he's 5'10". You know, you don't see many 5'10" goalkeepers, but really inspirational for a lot of goalkeepers listening in now, and I'm sure there's plenty that have that issue where they're not going to be 6'4", but just to know that actually you can still make the very top of your game, even if you're not 6 foot. You might have to do it the hard way. You might have to prove a lot of people wrong. And I think that really came through in that interview, that he spoke about that, wanting to prove people wrong, continually doing the job on the pitch. And if you're good enough, they can't ignore you.
Okay, and just to reiterate, the foundation and project that Jimmy mentioned in that interview was Football DNA, which you can find at footballdna.co.uk. Give it a look. Now, Rich, both you and Jimmy, as you said there, had a conversation about goalkeepers' heights, and one of the keepers you referenced in that chat was David De Gea, who conceded twice this weekend to Arsenal, the first of which from Granit Xhaka prompted some rather questionable analysis, shall we say, from all the usual suspects across BBC and Sky Sports. We're going to get onto that, but first, let's just decode the goal. I want to get your take on this, because
There are a few ways to look at it. One, was it an error from David De Gea? Two, how much of a part did the win play in the goal? And three, was this purely just a sublime bit of skill from Granit Xhaka that he hasn't actually received that much credit for?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, this De Gea one, because you watch it again and again, and of course it doesn't look particularly good. You know, I can certainly see that. It's not a fantastic strike, and it hasn't gone right in the corner. You look at it a couple of times, and certainly initially you'd think it's a goalkeeping error, but it's interesting when you see the shot from behind the strike, because the ball certainly starts to De Gea's left, hence why he goes to his left, and it does veer quite sharply to his right, and he's not able to get back, and it ends up going not even in the corner, but it certainly goes the other side, and he isn't able to get back. It isn't a knuckleball, which is quite interesting. It's more of a mishit, really. But I think it's a blend of that. And the second part to it is that I think the conditions played a part. It was an incredibly windy day. Now, often when you're playing in a stadium, you don't necessarily feel the wind, but you sometimes get a bit of a swirling effect. And I do think that that would have played a part. And any goalkeeper that's faced a shot when it's been a really windy day, they'll understand that it's almost worse when the wind is with you. You know, if the wind's against you, often you can read the shot that little bit better. But if the wind's with you and the shot is taken against the wind, the movement can be exaggerated. And although the ball might go a little bit slower, because the movement's exaggerated, it can make it that little bit tougher. And I just think for De Gea, it was a mixture of those two things. I don't think the conditions helped. And I think the fact that it was almost a bit of a mishit, started to his left, went to his right, was the reason that it looked as soft as it did.
Okay, so that's the goal. We're going to move on to the analysis now. There's quite a bit to get through, so I'll just read out the crux of what was said, and then you can offer your verdict or your analysis, as it were, of the analysis. Now, before Gary Neville has even seen the replay, and I'm pretty sure this is the way it goes, that everybody at home gets the same images that you see in the gantry. From my experience of being in press areas, that's how it is. You see exactly the same pictures. So when Granit Xhaka has shot and the ball's hit the net, instantly, Gary Neville says, the first thing to say when you see a goal go in like that is that you think deflection. It didn't get a deflection. It was really poor from David De Gea. He then sees the replay and quite poignantly, I think, says, I'm not quite sure how to explain that. Now, look, one might suggest the reason he's saying that is because actually he doesn't quite know what's happened in that situation and why David De Gea hasn't gone for the ball in the way that perhaps a lot of people think he should have done. He then goes on to say he's got a clear sight of it. It got a little bit of swerve on it, but I've got no defence for him. Poor from the goalkeeper. He's in the centre of his goal. The picture then cuts to De Gea, who's doing that sort of snake-like motion with his hands to suggest, look, the ball swerved. Neville says he's saying the ball swerved. It probably moved a yard. He'd committed himself. He gambled. He's got no real defence for himself at all. It's really weird. Sometimes you lose concentration as a footballer. That's the only way I can describe it. Martin Tyler then interjects. He's not a scathing, but essentially endorses Neville's views, and that's fair enough. He's there to mediate, as it were. But he does say David De Gea has gone from hero to zero, and then Jamie Redknapp weighs in and references De Gea's body language and said he's not looked quite right today. And then we have this true view, which Sky was celebrating as this intel that they've got. Look at this. We can see the view from David De Gea's perspective. It pretty much was the view that we could all see from behind the goal, but that's what it is. Jamie Redknapp says he's got a great view of it. No one's blocking him. He just moves to his left and the ball swerves to the right. Poor from his point of view. Bizarrely, the contract situation is then brought into the conversation between them, and Gary Neville says he's not had the best season, David De Gea. That's fair enough. That's fair comment. But we're then attributing that to the contract situation, the fact that perhaps other clubs have turned his head and the fact that Manchester United haven't been able to put an offer on the table that he's ready to sign yet. So this one error that he seemingly made, where the ball looks like it has deviated a fair bit, is being attributed to a whole load of other reasons. We then get to half-time and Jamie Carragher makes a good point and goes against the grain a little bit in De Gea's defence. He says, look, when you slow it down, it doesn't look great, but I wouldn't be too harsh on him. We then fast forward to full time and Graeme Souness says, because we've become so used to De Gea, saving far harder shots than that will be critical of him. Again, absolutely fair enough. By this point, Gary Neville is back in the studio, and you can tell there's maybe been a bit of back and forth between him and Carragher because he's upright, he's adamant, and he basically reiterates his thoughts on the fact that it's an error. He says it's not even a debate. The presenter, David Jones, obviously wants to try and ignite a debate between him and Carragher by saying, well, Carragher thinks otherwise. Neville's like, I can't understand why he does. It's in the centre of his goal from 30 yards. It's not even a debate. It's 4 yards inside the post. Carragher, to his credit, then brings up the replay and he says, look, the ball's moving here. It's in the centre. It's in the centre. It's in the centre. And then it deviates. And then it moves. Neville says, look, it swings early. Carragher says, no, it swings late. They have a bit of back and forth. But ultimately, Neville then bats it off and wants to move on to another point. But before he does that, quite importantly, he says, for that David De Gea error, Manchester United lost the game.
Now, look, you know, as a pundit, and I know we've made the point, they're outfield pundits, but what do they want to do? They want to make it black and white. It's either a mistake or it isn't a mistake. And you look at this goal, and of course, it's a shot from 30-odd yards. It's not blistering pace. It's not gone right in the corner. Therefore, to most pundits, they simply make it a mistake. It has to be black and white. What none of them have done is explain exactly what De Gea's done and spoke about him technically and whether it actually was an error, whether there's a reason for him doing what he's done. Now, you look at it, and it's quite obvious that when it struck, it is going to his left. So initially, he's read it very early. He's gone to his left, and it is as if it's taken a deflection and gone to his right. Jamie Carragher made a brilliant point. Had it had taken a deflection, would we have blamed him? No, we wouldn't. Well, effectively, that's what it's done. It's effectively taken a deflection in the air because it's moved so sharply to his right that he wasn't able to get back in time. Do I think that most goalkeepers concede that goal? Yes, absolutely. I think most Premier League goalkeepers concede that goal. So, you know, is it an error? If I was to give it an error rating, it'd probably be a 3 out of 10. The problem is it looks a lot worse than it actually is because it's so far out and it's not in the corner. It looks really, really bad, but that doesn't mean that it's a dreadful error. I mean, look, in terms of the punditry, and I feel like we've gone over this before, I like Gary Neville as an outfield pundit. Yes, his views on goalkeeping leave a lot to be desired, and I know he gets a lot of abuse for it, and he makes himself look a bit silly at times, but I think you have to take into account as well that he is a Man United fan, so he's quite emotional yesterday. Look, they've lost the game, he's looking for someone to blame, and he's chose the goalkeeper, wrongly, in my opinion, and I don't agree with his comments whatsoever, and I think I have to give a lot of credit to Jamie Carragher, because he's said it how it is, and he's gone against the grain. I think everybody else, again, they wanted to make it black and white, they wanted to make it a mistake, and that's what they've done. But look, it is what it is. De Gea's a strong lad. He's come back before many times. He'll come back again, and I'm sure this will just be a small blip in what's been a very good season for him.
A lot of people talking about Jordan Pickford because of his performance against Newcastle at St James's Park. Now, he's an interesting case because we've had the euphoric highs of the World Cup, and he's had something of an indifferent season. We've spoken about it quite a few times on this podcast. And last week, he kept a clean sheet against Liverpool, which was something of a redemption after the mistake he made in the previous game at Anfield against Liverpool for Everton. But then this week, he's saved a penalty after conceding a penalty. And then he's gone on to have quite an erratic performance. I think that's the best way that you can describe it, is erratic. What's your take on him?
It was interesting. He looked flustered, if I'm honest. Like, body language, he looked rushed, he looked hurried. There's something in performance, and I don't know if it's a psychological thing, but they call it the inverted U, which effectively goes from, say, being really calm to being really tense. And the point is that you reach your peak, it's different for everyone. So some people, they need to be really, really calm, and that's when they're at their optimum to go and play a game of football. Similarly, some people need to be really tense, and that's when they're at their optimum. There's no right or wrong when it comes to that. I just wonder with Jordan Pickford whether he was too excited, a little bit nervous. Looking at him, of course, there's a few factors here. So first and foremost, if people put their minds back, the game before, it might have been the last game of last season at St James's Park, he had a bad day that day, made an error for a goal. It was just before the World Cup. And after that performance, there were a few question marks whether he would be number one, because it wasn't a particularly good performance. So you wonder whether the previous performance at St James's Park came into his mind. Let's not forget, he's a Sunderland boy. Does that come into his mind, that there is that rivalry between the two, and going there, he might have felt that he had a point to prove? It was strange, though. The goals themselves, the penalty, you know, the cross, it was a reasonably basic cross, and he just looked like he was all over the place, and then obviously gave away the penalty, redeemed himself to an extent by saving the penalty. But then certainly the first two goals, The first one, I need to see it again. There may well have been a very slight deflection, so you might let him off that one. But certainly the second one, my first thought was it must have moved all over the place, given the reaction that he's given it. But you watch it from behind, and it doesn't look like it's a knuckleball. It looks like there's a little bit of spin on it, and he just doesn't pick up the flight of the ball, and his parry comes straight back out, and they score the goal. And it just one of those afternoons, he just looked, you use the word, he looked erratic. And I think for Jordan Pickford, after having the incredible World Cup that he did, this season hasn't been his best, and I'm sure he would admit that. He's had some really, really good games, but too many mistakes. So I think for him, this is going to be a big learning curve this season, and I hope for his sake that he's able to eradicate those one or two errors that we've seen this season and learn from it. And I'm sure that he'll retain his position as England number one. He has got a bit of a challenge on his hands from the likes of Tom Heaton. Obviously, Ben Foster, I know he's retired, and the likes of Butland, and of course, McCarthy and Gunn at Southampton, and Bettinelli, and a few others as well. So I'm sure he'll retain his place, but he just needs to be a little bit careful that there are people coming up behind that will want that spot. And from his point of view, he does need to finish the season strong, you feel?
That first goal did take a deflection, but it took a deflection towards him. And that's where some people look at it and go, well, hang on, hasn't that helped him rather than hinder him?
It will never help, because you'll always go for the initial ball. And even if the deflection's very, very close, it's amazing how the mind works. As soon as the ball struck, you then react to that. So he will have been going down to his left, far to his left. Then when it comes in, it's that gap between your leg and your arm, effectively, and it can be a really awkward place to get your hand back to. So that's why I say it was one that doesn't look good. I wouldn't necessarily say it was a bad error. I love the whole error rating. If I was giving it an error rating, it'd be a 3 out of 10. But no, certainly the next goal, that is an error, and I think that he will hold his hands up. It's a shot that's struck with a bit of ferocity, but he looks like he's all over the place. And it's just in terms of a parry, he's parried it straight back out in front. If he felt he needed to parry, then a calmer parry out to the side, out for a corner, would have made a lot more sense.
There is a flip side to this whole argument, and that's the fact that he does seem to remain smiling. Now, we live in a world now where footballers are constantly scrutinised, and we're telling them that they need to enjoy themselves, that they need to relate to the fans. And Ian Wright on Match of the Day said, in response to the clip of Pickford kind of sticking his tongue out at the Newcastle fans when that shot went just wide, he said that he needs to concentrate more on the game and not be concerned with having fun with the fans. But then you go, okay, so what do we want from these players? Because now we're complaining that they're having too much fun.
I don't mind that. I mean, do you know what? And if they'd have gone and won the game 1-0, that'd have been highlighted as, isn't that brilliant, Jordan Pickford? Yet they lose the game, so now it's seen in the opposite light. Like, it's the same action judged completely differently based on the outcome. I don't mind that. You know, for me, one of Jordan Pickford's biggest strengths is his mentality. He is mentally so strong. I still believe it's the hardest position on the field to play mentally, goalkeeper. You know, you've got, more often than not, you're the villain as opposed to being the hero. So why not enjoy it? We're seeing it from the likes of, obviously, Jordan Pickford. Ben Foster, we mention him every episode, but we see it from him a lot. He enjoys playing in goal. And this should be a lesson for every young goalkeeper. Don't worry about making mistakes. Of course, don't be lazy in your approach and accept mistakes, but don't be afraid of making mistakes. Play to play your best game and enjoy being a goalkeeper, and knowing that when you make mistakes, you can learn from them. So I think we just got to be really careful as a pundit as to knock the joy out of goalkeeping and knock the joy out of being your own character and expressing yourself in the way that you want to express yourself.
Just a very quick word on Ben Foster and that first Manchester City goal last night, Raheem Sterling. Obviously, there's a whole load of talk about the fact that it was offside, and it was offside, 100%. What is that like from a goalkeeper's perspective? We can look at it from a goalkeeper's perspective, in the sense that, you know, Daryl Yanmar is there and has slid in to tackle Raheem Sterling. That's one argument. But Ben Foster is obviously quite advanced because of the position that Raheem Sterling's in. So from a goalkeeper's perspective, how are you viewing that goal?
You make your decision on your positioning based on probability. So, and I may have said this before, but I'll repeat what I've said before, is that sometimes you can make the wrong decision and get the right outcome. Sometimes you can make the right decision and get the wrong outcome. You look at where that shot's being struck from. Is Ben Foster in a good position? I would say yes. Is it usual for the ball to loop up like that? And as you say, it was a clearance from the defender onto Sterling, up over his head in the net. No, the probability of that happening is very, very low. So Ben Foster's decision-making there in terms of positioning gives him a very good chance of making the save. Unfortunately for him, in that particular circumstance, it was a very improbable thing that happened, which, of course, led to the goal.
Splendid. Well, that's it for another week, mate.
Fantastic.
Enjoy the show.
It's been excellent. It always is. It always is. Hence, and we've got to say a big thank you, actually. I'm very aware. You keep me informed of the figures every week, and they're continually rising. You guys obviously letting your friends know about what we're doing, and I see we're well into the thousands now each week. So just from a personal point of view, just want to say a big thank you for listening in and continually to spread the good goalkeeping word.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear, mate. Well, as we say every week, please do drop us a line. It's very easy to get in contact with us on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official. Just search GK Union on Facebook or send us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon.